CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. We've got Michael Flax with us today and Sia Sangweni, and we've got lots of good stuff coming up for you. In fact, Pepe Marais is going to be joining us in a short while. He's the founding partner of Joe Public United, and he's an incredibly successful man all in his own right. But he's also written a new book, which is called Growing Greatness, A Journey Towards Personal and Business Mastery. So if that's the kind of subject matter that you're interested in, you're in for a treat today. His previous book. His new book is called 20 Habits That Break Habits. And we're going to talk to him about that. So I'm excited to speak to Pepe. He'll be joining us just in a short while. Those fires in Cape Town, man, that seems to be something everybody's talking about. I have friends in Cape Town, and they actually decided, because they've got young kids, that they were going to evacuate and go somewhere else. So they got in the car yesterday, locked up the house, and drove out somewhere else. They're going to stay in a hotel because the kids are coughing. And I'm telling you that those fires have created such a problem. And obviously there's been huge destruction. As far as I know, up to now, no one's died, but that might have changed, you know, because a lot of people with, you know, respiratory difficulties might have already succumbed. There might be people who've been fighting the fires, and we know how brave firefighters are putting their lives at risk in order to control the fires. They could also be in great danger. But if you know anybody who's in Cape Town at the moment, it might be worth just checking in on them, making sure they're okay. It's very scary. See how quickly that fire spreads.
It's been beautiful to see how, like, people are getting together, and like companies are like making it easily and more accessible to help. Like, a very caring person was sharing with me all the companies that are helping. Like, even the Kiffness has a genius idea. Like, we're heading towards winter. Yeah. They've come out with a onesie where they're selling, and proceeds go to help people that have been affected. Like, Radisson Blue Hotel's giving discounted rates. SBCA is helping. I love it when like companies come together and they're like lower their guard, and it's no longer about money, and it's about helping people. And that's the world I want to live in, where people want to help people, not for monetary gain.
Yeah.
Look, I knew it was bad, but I didn't know it was this bad. You know, when you get numbers, it provides you more context to things. There are an estimated 4,000 UCT students alone that have had to be evacuated and moved out of their race because of this. 4,000 people. That's just UCT. That doesn't count the families and people who are around there. This is a lot.
I've seen these horrible pictures of what the UCT library looks like now. Very, very sad. I mean, just the most awful thing to see the inside of that building just gutted, and you think about all those books, and you know, some. I mean, UCT's it's an old institution, a venerable old institution, full of really interesting and unique documents that are, many of them may have gone. I mean, I was talking to someone yesterday. Apparently, they have strong rooms there, and some of those strong rooms, some of those fireproof rooms, may have saved the very very, you know, very special and important and collectible things, but a lot of it's just gone up in smoke. And you know, it's scary when a fire gets into a residential area, and we've spoken about this. In fact, we were talking about Cape Town fires, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago in the news, when we said that the Western Cape provincial government is getting ready to deal with the way fires spread in the Cape, especially in informal settlements where it just jumps from one place to the next. And if it gets into residential areas, man, because Cape Town's quite densely packed, there aren't a lot of open spaces outside of the actual nature reserve and the mountain itself. If it gets into a suburb, and especially where there are flats or there are buildings that are super close together, obviously informal settlements, which we've mentioned, then it just gets really bad really quickly. So, you know, I'm just thinking of the people in Cape Town today, and I suppose we all are.
I was looking at the photos and, like, the fire trucks and how they were, like, treating the fires. And I disagree with our current methods of, like, treating fires. Like, a hose pipe with water and a couple fire trucks is just not enough. I think we need a new method to sort of, like, drain out the oxygen. And the army should have been called in straight away. We should have every single available water source just to deplete this fire in like an hour.
Yeah, but Flax,
it should not be spreading.
That's easier said than done, hey? I mean, that's...
It needs to be done and said.
Yeah, look, they're doing everything. They're doing everything they can. I mean, they're dumping water on from helicopters. They've got the fire engines deployed to wherever they can. But there's only so much infrastructure that you have ready to go in order to deal with a fire like this. So I think they're doing the best they can. I don't think anyone's sitting there, you know, just hoping something will happen. I don't think that the government are just sitting there doing nothing.
I just feel like, so I watched a video where a helicopter went and dropped a little bucket in a school pool and then went to the fire. And I'm just thinking, like, surely we can invent something that, like, depletes the fire faster than a bucket and water. Like, surely there's a substance that drains out the oxygen from fires. Or, like, imagine,
it'll also kill everything in the area. If you drain the oxygen away, all the animals and people in that area will also suffer and die. So you got to be careful. Also, Flax, you can't do more than they're doing. I mean, a fire spreads, and when the wind picks up, then what it does is it actually fans the flames, and it makes the fire bigger, and it spreads it faster because it actually pushes it along. That's the danger. And for the last 2 days, they've had quite a lot of wind.
I'm interested as... You know, we find out more details here about the origin of the fire and what had happened there. I'm not being naive, but I really don't want to think that someone had the sole intention of purposefully, you know, getting all of this or making all of this damage. They have one suspect that they're currently looking at.
They have arrested. They have arrested one person.
Started a fire, and left it there.
You know, if it does turn out that this is arson, and it's amazing how these guys, these forensic scientists, can actually find out where the fire started, because they're able to trace back to precisely where it all began. And if they can find people, I think they must prosecute these people to the full extent of the law. Because if you set fire to things and you think that you won't be caught and it ends up causing all of this damage, it's just devastating. Someone's got to pay the price, right? And if you can actually find out if someone did it maliciously, like a lot of these people will admit to it. Apparently, this guy who they've arrested actually admitted to starting a fire. And I think we all deserve to know who that person is, frankly. I want to know
what
their
motive
is.
Do we not have satellites that like film everything that we could just like go back a couple days and just get the video footage?
Brother's not watching.
Yeah, I mean there are satellites that are observing things, but Flax, you never know where they are at any given time. Usually they're focused on one particular area, and they don't, you know, satellites don't stay still. So you have to keep changing satellites, and you need a huge amount of money to do that. Plus they're not filming in HD, you know, they can't like pick up facial features from space. So there are some that can, but we don't have any of those. And I promise you that there's no one in South Africa who has the kind of money to have that sort of satellite tracking constantly, that kind of satellite observation available 24/7. No one.
I guess.
Maybe the U.S. military. Look, that's about it.
We're all just throwing out suspicions here. But, Gareth, what do you think? Do you think it's someone who had ill intention, or do you think perhaps it might have been a homeless guy who was making a fire but was irresponsible enough to just leave it after it got warm?
I mean, I don't know. These things sometimes start off naturally. You know, there could be a spark or a bolt of lightning, or it's rare, but it does happen where it's an act of God, so to speak. In this case, it is suspicious to me that it started at UCT. Because we know that the universities are currently a locus of real malcontents. There are a whole lot of people who are complaining. And
locus of who?
Malcontents means malcontents are people who are unhappy, Sia. People who are So I think that there may be some
root word there being
malcontents.
Why would you say malcontent instead of just not content?
Because it's one word rather than two. It's economy.
But everyone understands not content.
Well, if you take 5 seconds, you'll figure out malcontent. Anyway, the fact is that these people, that we know that there are a lot of unhappy students, right? And we know that there's a huge amount of tension on South Africa's university campuses. And I suspect that they may be linked, although that I don't have any evidence at the moment for that. It could also just be some really angry, antisocial misfit who, you know, like these school shooters or anybody like that, and this person just felt like being destructive. If it turns out that that is the case, then that's very, very sad, because now currently Cape Town is experiencing the absolute worst. We're going to go to Pepe Maria just now, and I want to go to him a bit earlier than usual this morning because we've got Blind History coming up a bit later on, and I know there are lots of people who want to speak to Pepe. We want to talk about his new book, which is called 20 Habits That Break Habits. And I love the book because, first of all, it's packaged to almost look like a box of cigarettes, which I love, since we're talking about habits. So here he is, Pepe Maria. How are you, Pepe? Nice to see you, man. Now you're on mute.
Just on mute.
There we go.
I said, let me unmute. A daily mistake. Good morning, Gareth.
Absolutely. Nice. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's good to see you. I'm sorry it's taken us so long to actually get you on the show, because I received your book, it's last year already, and I loved, first of all, the idea of packaging it like that was just so clever. So congratulations. How's the book doing?
This one is doing a bit slower than the first one. The first one actually surprised me. But this one's a bit slow, but I think it's also the state of the world, you know. I know sales and exclusives down by like 40%, so it's impacting it. But, I mean, I'm not in it to sell, make money out of it. So whoever reads it, that's good enough for
me. No, I'm afraid that none of us are going to be like J.K. Rowling rich out of our books, right?
True story.
It is astonishing, just to give people the background, that Pepe Maria has been able to raise the bar, not only at Joe Public United, which is an incredible agency, but also serve people, inspire and assist everybody towards being the best version of themselves through his books. If you haven't done it yet, you've got to check out his first book, which is called Growing Greatness, A Journey Towards Personal and Business Mastery. And he's just brought out this new one. So tell me about this book and why you decided to do a second one.
So the first one, you know, Gareth, I'm very purpose driven in my life. I mean, it was quite a change from what I used to, the life I used to live to the life I live now. It was a huge change for me in 2007. So the first book was almost, I know entrepreneurs are needed in this country. So the first book was in service of entrepreneurs and sharing my business journey with my partners to show that, you know, it's overnight success doesn't exist. You know, it's really, it's not a truth, you know, and there's a famous saying that says it takes 17 years to become an overnight success. So it's a long journey, and I wanted to share that journey. And then I also wanted to plant the seed of the power of purpose within a business, which is something that we put at the core of Joe Public back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the reason for the first book. And then the second book was just an idea I had to do the social experiment, because I'm an ex-smoker, you know, I smoked for 18 years. So I just had this very strange idea, and then in the end, I didn't know COVID was coming, and I had to write this book in lockdown amidst a lot of other things. So it was just an idea.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and it clearly is, you know, in order to write a book, you really have something, you have to have something to say. You have to feel like there's a contribution you can make here, and I think it's great, because let me tell you, writing a book, and I've experienced this having written two, it's not easy. You have to commit to writing. You know, you're used to talking and you're used to running a business, and all of that stuff is good and well, but you're actually judged there by the numbers and by the results. When you write a book, people can quote you 100 years after you're dead in your book, and you have to think very carefully about what you commit to paper there, because you will be held to account for everything that you write down. It's a lot more complex writing a book than anything else. So let's just talk about purpose, because I've believed for the longest time that this is one of those things that is missing for so many people, and particularly young people. They realize that there is more to life than, you know, being popular on social media or having money or getting your rocks off, whether that's just having fun, you know, experiencing the euphoria and the highs of life and being a hedonist. There is more to life than that. And purpose is very difficult to define because it's so different for everybody. What is your definition of that? And how do you think you can help explain to people who are feeling that emptiness that a lack of purpose gives you, what they should do to fix that, how you can rectify it?
So, you know, I think I did a very deep transformational workshop because our business went pretty much bankrupt more than a decade ago with that 2008-2009 recession. And I went through really sort of, I'm a very positive person. I went through quite a little bit of a dark valley. And I started questioning life. So I discovered a very deep transformational workshop that I did. But I think why it resonated with me is because I'm very strategic. And in business, or particularly in advertising and branding, marketing, we deal with strategy for brands. And brands all have these 3 to 5 year plans. And I started realizing I don't have a 3 to 5 year plan for my life. I'm just living weekend to weekend. And that was the beginning of my journey. So to me, purpose is actually strategy for your life. If I speak on a personal level, then for me, purpose is strategy for my life. So I'm I'm crystal clear on what my strategy is and what my approach is in all my endeavors, whether it's as a husband, a father, a business leader, a creative person, you know, and I found that everything actually then started following that strategy, which just means I had a plan. And actually, in all honesty, the second book is also based on my strategy.
Now, when you talk about a plan or a strategy for life, for many people, that sounds like the kind of thing you hear in corporates. They talk about this stuff, but I need to know, because you're a practical guy too. Does this mean writing down all the things you want, all the things you don't want, who you want to be working with, what kinds of personal goals you want to achieve? How does a plan like that become something practical for you to work on?
That's great. Okay, great. So I'd say the first step is to understand the power of one word. You know, in the world, there's 42,000 listed entities across the globe on all the stock exchanges. And then who knows how many thousands of extra sort of non-listed entities. Mm. I can only find three where there's clarity on the one word that brand stands for. So purpose to me is defining one word that you stand for on a personal level as a person. Mm. It's almost your ultimate one word value is the starting point. Now, whether that is love or care or freedom or greatness, or, you know, it could be any word of value. But each person in my experience have a deep unconscious word. It's almost like your personal name, like Gareth.
Yeah.
Gareth is your human name. And my hypothesis, and it's through my experience, it's not factual based, but it's through experience, I've learned that each person has an unconscious word that is the most valuable word in your life. And once you uncover that word, you need to work out what that word means. Because in the absence of working out what that word means, you will not have a defined purpose. So I'll give you an example. Joe Public, the purpose word of our business is growth.
Okay.
Now, anyone would go at face value, well, that's obvious. The business wants to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But when you took the time to define the word growth, it means to be the fertile soil that grows our people, our clients, and our country. So now suddenly we've got a concept to build a business on. Fertile soil doesn't mean just any soil. So if we grow people, they don't just grow like this. We grow them exponentially to the best of our ability. So we've got people, we've got clients, and we know if we want to play a role in growing them, our product has to be superior. That's the only service we can give to them in that the wheel of marketing. And then country growth is our contribution through job creation, our taxes, and also our endeavors in township schools, which we support.
Yes.
So all those secondary goals that we set our business are all derived from growth to be the fertile soil that grows our people, clients, and country. So for me, it starts with one word. Define that word.
That's hard. That's not an easy thing to do. Do you have a personal word as well that's not Joe Public, that's Pepe Marais?
Yeah, no, I do. So my personal word is greatness.
Okay.
And at face value, it seems like it's the most important word in the world, a word in the world, and it's not. It's just a word. But what it means is to bring out the best in those around me. So that's my endeavor.
So, all right. You see how the before we carry on, sorry to interrupt you, Pepe, but you said once you've got your word. But for many of us, that's really hard. That's difficult to do because there's so many words that we would use to describe ourselves. There's so many things that we think of when we think of ourselves. Most people's identities and purpose is complex. So to narrow it down, is there a process that you could go through? Like anybody who's listening to us now, is there a formula you can apply in order to narrow down 10 words that say people would write down about themselves and make it just one?
You see, the sad, unfortunate truth is the place that I used, which was called the Center of Light. And that was just, I've got growth mindset, so I throw myself at any crazy experience. They actually, through the COVID-19, in the process of closing down. But I think that's the way, now when people are really starting to ask these questions, because off my first book, a lot of people went through that same experience. Because it is such a deep unconscious journey to find that one word. And you're right, we are complex. How do you distill it down to one word? But I think just to be conscious of the potential that there is a word as powerful as your word given to you by your parents that's in your unconscious, and just to start searching for it could be an interesting process. But I know fundamentally that it's true that each of us have a very unique word to us, to our identities unconsciously. That I know for a fact.
All right. I love that. And I think for many of us, this means that we're going to have to go off today and start coming up with precisely what that one word is. And it may be for some of us harder than others, but that'll help you. And then from there, you build it out. So now that you've decided that that's your word and you've defined it properly, and you figured out how you're going to make that word into the thing that describes your life for the next 3 to 5 years, for a lot of people, life gets in the way, right? They forget that, I mean, this is easier said than done, but if you apply this thing properly, it should affect and improve all areas of your life. But for many people, they're just trying to survive, and they've got bills to pay, and they've got daily responsibilities and all of that stuff, and it can be distracting, Pepe. You know, it's almost like, you know, if you're in survival mode and you're worried about the next meal, it's very hard to think about your word because your stomach is gnawing at you. So how do we get past that, especially in a country where we've got so many people who are unemployed, so many people who are in poverty, so many people who are in broken homes and who are abused and haven't got much to build a future on? What do you say to them? Because it sounds theoretical to those people.
Look, I have to say, the journey of discovering your purpose, and I mean, it's a very privileged journey. I have to agree with you there. I mean, I'm way beyond just survival mode. But what I can say is when I went on the journey, I was in survival mode. I had nothing, but not close to the nothing that the majority of our country have, you know. But at least I have some context that it was not at that stage. There was a huge insight that all my endeavors did not result in financial benefit. But when I applied that focus to my life, the money came naturally and in abundance. Almost I can't describe it because my output did not improve. It was my intention that changed. So I still think that even if you come from absolutely nothing, like I would love to bring this methodology into the educational system of South Africa.
Yeah,
because I think you can plant it into the consciousness of children and start at that age to find your focus of your life. And it's not your job and it's not your career and your craft and that passion. It is something that makes that passion even more worthwhile. I would love to bring it in at that level. So that's part of my long-term body plan.
I just love that line that you used now. Your output didn't change, your intention did. That's a massive mind shift, and anyone can do that, right, Pepe? You don't have to be a university educated philosophy student to figure out how to do that. You can do it in small things, then you can do it in big things too.
Absolutely. It's actually about responsibility, because it's very easy for me to blame the fact that my father was a drunken lunatic that almost shot us And he almost killed us at the age of when I was 3.
Wow.
Now I can easily use that and blame that for my way I behave today, or I can take responsibility for that and learn from it and become better through it. So that's why I think it's a shift in intention, not necessarily what you do. It's why you do what you do.
I'm going to let Flax and Sia come in just now with some questions, but I've got one more for you while we're talking about philosophy. I notice in your book that you do talk about the Aristotle, you know, his insights, because Aristotle was this great Greek philosopher who learnt from Socrates and Plato, and was also Alexander the Great's teacher. And some of the stuff that he said all those years ago, is what, 2,300 odd years ago, that stuff's still valuable now. How much of that did you go into, and what kind of a scaffolding did it produce for you to figure out those habits?
Yeah. Look, in truth, although I am studying, I'm studying towards a PhD at the moment. It's a hell of a journey.
What's the PhD in?
It's going to be in purpose. So okay. I'm only finishing my MBA this year because I'm not uneducated. I've got a design diploma from an art school. Yep. So I had to do a PDM to get into MBA. I'm doing my MBA to get into my PhD. But it's all to put, you know, perceptually, to put more punch behind my assumptions around purpose.
Right.
You know, when I'm Dr. Pepe Marais speaking on purpose because I've done a PhD in purpose for business, I'm going to be more believable. It's just the way we are. You know?
You would think that you'd had enough success for people to sit up and take notes. And I mean, you've already sold books, which is more than I can say for most doctors in the arts.
Yeah. Look, one can say that, but I had an experience once again where I told a fib because I could choose between Mr., Mrs. and Doctor at a big talk to entrepreneurs, and I just chose Doctor. And I saw the response. Well, but maybe it's also my assumption, but that's what gave me the idea to get a doctorate, because I thought, you know, it will be a great journey to get more input. But to your question, I don't research. I only research now in my studies, but writing a book, I write on intuition and experience.
Okay.
But all this knowledge I know is not my cleverness. This has been around for thousands of years. We've just not been conscious enough to try and apply it as human beings, you know. So I think COVID-19 is also shifting our way of being.
Flax and Sia, I'm going to bring you guys back in here because I know you both are interested in and follow what Pepe's up to. So, Flax, is there something on your mind that you want to ask? Have you read the book, or are you interested in reading the book, 20 Habits? Have you discovered any things that you can do to break bad habits and to bring good ones in?
So I haven't read the book yet. Definitely will read it. It's come up on my social media. Great advertising on the book, I must say. The concept of purpose I find very interesting, because half of me believes I have a purpose and the other half believes I'm wasting my time looking for my purpose, because my purpose is going to change on a day-to-day basis. And if I knew my purpose and if I knew why God put me on this earth, would it really be that fun? So my sort of version, like, pivots around what am I good at so that I can sort of focus on one thing, because I agree when Elon Musk says, a lot of people say, don't put your eggs in one basket. Elon Musk says, put your eggs in one basket and watch the basket. So I believe you should focus on one thing that you're good at and harness that. So when I'm looking for my purpose and why I'm on this earth, I'm 28 years old, and that literally confuses me. Like, why am I here? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. So I prefer not to chase my purpose or even look for my purpose, and rather just day to day deal with the cards that are dealt to me, if that makes sense.
You see, so I found my purpose at 38. And if you ask me, like, I take life as it comes because that's my journey. I never sort of question why things happen. I believe it all happens for a reason to take me to a certain place.
Mm.
But if I was as clear as I became at the age of 38, it would be profound how much further I would be now, knowing what I know now. So, and just to your point of fun, because that's always the worry. Ooh, this sounds very serious.
Yeah.
Let me tell you that my life pre-purpose, I might have outwardly looked like a fun guy. I was the life of all parties with my bells on my shoes and my long hair, and I played in bands. I did all this stuff. Inside, I was in turmoil. I was anxious. I had high levels of anxiety. I had social phobia. once I discovered my purpose with that clarity, I became so calm inside. So my life is, honestly, you ask the people in my department, the creative people at Joe Public, we're having fun. In a high-pressure environment, we are having a lot of fun. So purpose to me is at the heart of fun because it takes away so much anxiety. So if I give you an example, to bring out the best in people, I can do that at home. I can do it at Joe Public. I can do it in my talks. I can do it in my books. It's just that direction. And then when I behave like a total asshole, which I did the other day when I shouted at someone who drove me off the road because I had a bad morning, I was completely off purpose. Yeah. So I'm not always on purpose, but at least I knew I was wrong. At least I could correct.
This is amazing because you actually, I mean, the title of the book is 20 Habits That Break Habits. But actually the way you're talking now is almost like an addict who you're never completely not addicted. You have to work at this every day. And working at purpose, as I understand it from you, it's an ongoing task. It's not a battle. It's not necessarily something that's awful. It's actually something that can be tremendously fun and very rewarding. But it never stops. Yeah. You've never found your purpose done. Now we can relax. Now everything's sorted.
Yeah. Gareth, in the book, I don't know if any of you guys have snow skied, okay, but I started with a green slope and then I went up to blue and eventually red and I skied black slopes. And I tell you, black slopes are 1,000 times more fun than
Absolutely.
A green slope.
Absolutely.
They both get you from the top to the bottom of the mountain, but the one, and I find most of us live our lives on the green slope because it's easier. The things that actually are tougher, they grow us. And they are more fun. They're scary as hell, but when you get through them, they're more fun. So when you ask me about fun, I can tell you my life, I have a very, very, very fun life. It doesn't always have to reflect on my face as big smiles.
Yeah.
But my sense inside of fulfillment is insane. And I attribute that through the clarity of purpose, or to the clarity of purpose.
Now, what
I just had an epiphany, and I don't think purpose is the destination anymore. I think purpose is the journey.
Purpose, spot on, man. You know, business books, business, MBA teach you that a business starts with a vision. They're confused in my book because you start with a purpose. That is the journey. And the purpose will inspire a completely different vision. My vision used to make X amount of million by 50, buy a yacht, sail the world. Now, what's the value on that? My vision's now to play a significant role in changing this country, which of course is like quite a, not a burden, but it's quite a task. But it excites me because it's like, okay, it makes me feel that I'm bringing more value in this lifetime, even if I don't achieve it. Because you're right, it's a journey. And purpose is a journey because it's where you come from as a human being.
And
I feel like people get mistaken. They like feel like once they find their purpose, they can just go sit in the lazy river and they've already figured it out. No. And I don't think that is how it works.
No,
Pepe, you just hinted at one last thing, and we've got to wrap this up because we've got to get to blind history for this morning. But before you go, you said just a second ago that, you know, it may be quite a big ask for you to say you want to play a significant role in the future of this country. But do you think that many people, based on your green slopes versus black slopes comment, many people, they set the bar too low because they're afraid of failing. And especially in South Africa, we have this idea that humility in and of itself is a virtue. We need to be more ambitious for ourselves, and we need to be more ambitious for our country, because at the moment we're in survival mode, and there are too many people in South Africa who are really doing just enough to eke out an existence and just enough to get through the day. And those people who do take the risks and those people who believe in themselves and those people who aim high enough, it seems to me that the rewards come to them much more easily than even they would expect.
Yeah, that dovetails perfectly into that intention. And I think when you go into this world to truly serve others without wanting to get back, it is quite profound what you get back. That's why I'm saying it's a subtle shift. I was very self-serving before the age of 38. I was a good person. I wasn't a bad person, but I was self-serving. And when I just made that subtle change in service of others, I mean, I sometimes have to pinch myself for things I get to do. And I don't even think that I've personally, or my business, or our business, not my business, our business is a collective of people. We haven't even begun to add value, the value that we can. So it's a truly exciting journey. It really is. And when I, you know, if anyone listens and it sort of resonates, then just go on that little search. Figure it out. Makes life a bit more exciting, you know. Otherwise, it's just the same, mundane, every day, every week. Hey, hey, it's Friday. And, you know, it's like Groundhog Day.
No, I agree with you. And I've felt like that a lot recently. So it's maybe time for me to set out that 3 to 5 year plan now and get off my ass and actually do something useful. All right. Thank you very much.
You do a hell of a lot, Gareth.
Yeah, I don't know. Hey, you know, the point is, if I said to you, you've already done enough, you'd swear at me because it's never enough. You need to have a reason to wake up in the morning and make a difference. So Pepe, thank you. And well done for writing 20 Habits That Break Habits. And that's a great place to start. Yeah. If you've heard anything that Pepe said this morning and it's done for you what it seems to have done for Flax, and it's also hit a couple of nerves with me this morning, then pick up the book and that's where you start. 20 Habits That Break Habits. Pepe Maria, thank you very much for joining us.
Really appreciate it. Much appreciate it.
Good to see you. Thanks, Pepe. What an interesting dude, huh? I mean, and so many things he said there are just ringing in my ears right now. I actually took some notes. I wrote down a whole bunch of notes. So, see?
I feel like I'm going to live life a lot different now that I know purpose is the journey and not the destination.
Yeah, I think that was a smart thing to pick up there. All right, listen, we've got to move on to Blind History. It is time for us to introduce to you the subject for Blind History for this morning. We actually spoke about him with respect to the funeral of Prince Philip, which happened over the weekend, and he is King George III. So King George III is well known for a couple of things. He's well known for losing the United States of America as a colony, because during his reign, they declared independence. He's also known for having the third longest reign in British history. The longest reign being the current Queen, the second longest being Queen Victoria, and the third longest being George III. And he was a really interesting guy. I mean, very, very clever. He did go mad towards the end of his reign, which also made him really interesting. He went completely mad. He was suffering from something called porphyria, but they believe there were also perhaps other kinds of mental illness which weren't diagnosed at the time that he suffered from. But he went bonkers. And you can hear all about him in the latest episode of Blind History. It's one of my favorites. He is a really fascinating guy. And I think you'll enjoy this. It's another one, our second episode in the fifth season of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. This is cliffcentral.com. The signs of the king's madness were there early on. He once asked his surgeon to get the Spanish to swap Gibraltar for Menorca. He would run up to farmers and give them advice on breeding better pigs. He also thought he could control the weather with his mind. At the end of his life, King George III was completely mad. But during his reign, he was arguably a good deal smarter than any British royal, before or since. His book collection formed the basis of the British Library, and he was the patron of Handel's Hallelujah Chorus. He may have lost America, but King George III won over all of Britain. Blind History, Season 5, and a character that I've been looking forward to getting to for a long time. Anthony and I always talk about who we should have on the show in terms of these great historical figures. This guy kind of slides under the radar a little bit, but he was the longest lived and longest serving King of England. Before the Queen came along and before Victoria came along, he was the longest running reigning monarch in British history. And his name is George III. Most people know only a few things about him. They know that he lost America, which is unfair. We'll get to that. They know that he went mad, which is also unfair. We'll get to that. And that he had 15 children, which was true, and we'll get to that as well. But what an interesting guy.
Incredible. I didn't really know that he was such an interesting person.
So George III was actually the grandson of George II, and they paid him no attention until his father, George III's father, died, and he became the next in line to the throne. And then suddenly George II took an interest in him, said to him, at an early age of about 14 or 15, right, we're going to set you up in your own lavish apartments in St. James's Palace. And his first decision as heir apparent was to say, no, I don't want to do that. I'll continue to live with my mother and I'll continue to have my family around me. As a young boy, he didn't want any of the money and the luxury of having his own household. And his mother was quite strict. as I understand it. He was quite strict on himself, and he had a number of tutors through his childhood who obviously infused a very strong sense of morality and of principle and of discipline in George III, because this guy grew up believing that certain things are right, certain things are wrong, and you couldn't persuade him otherwise. He wasn't going to be, you know, bought over by the promise of pleasure or luxury. For the whole of his life, that one decision kind of set the tone for the way that he would live. And although his reign has been marked by, you know, the colonies, America in particular, rebelling against him, there was so much that went on that was so good. Scientific development, the agricultural revolution, setting the scene for the industrial revolution, all of that took place under George III. He was the first English monarch of his dynasty, the Hanoverians, to speak English and to only live in England. He never left England.
And he loved that. You know, he was English through and through. Yeah. And he said that in his coronation, I believe. You know,
that's right.
I was born in England. I am English.
Yeah.
Where his grandfather and his father,
they only spoke German.
They were proper German. They could hardly speak English. And funny enough, his father, just on the side note, was, his father loved cricket and he was quite good at cricket.
Yes.
And apparently that had some, maybe have something to do with his early death. And that's why he never came to the throne. Although his father, being George III's grandfather, really didn't want him on the throne.
Well, the Hanoverians always hated their heirs. They used to say terrible things about, all the way down to Victoria. They hated their heirs. Mm. So the father always hated their son, and the feeling was mutual, going down every generation from George I all the way to Edward VII. And somehow, luckily, it broke at some point. But George III
was... But we don't know that, do we?
Well,
with,
yeah,
Elizabeth, I mean,
maybe she still hates Charles, who knows?
Yeah.
And they are still Hanoverians, whether they like it or not. So George was really interesting because he was very intelligent. He read prolifically. He wrote all the time. There is a collection of George III's letters in the Royal Archives in Windsor, which they actually did a documentary on about 5 or 6 years ago, which has just been released to the public. And it's incredible. Personal letters to his own family and his children and his friends. Letters to politicians. He was very involved in the politics of the day. He knew everything that was going on. If there was an expedition to the Galapagos, he knew about it. If there was a new telescope being unveiled somewhere, he knew about it. He had astronomical clocks that had been given to him by, you know, his admirers, and because he was patron of various science foundations. He supported the arts, you know, Handel. He started the biggest collection of books in Britain.
And the Museum of the Arts, was started by him?
Many different foundations and museums that supported all kinds of endeavors were started under George III. And he would arrange his day around eclipses and planetary alignments. And he had the most sophisticated scientific equipment that any monarch has had. He's probably the cleverest person to have sat on the throne of England. And I mean no disrespect to any of the
rest. And a very, very high work ethic. It was amazing what he got through.
Incredible.
And a lot was thrown at him. I mean, when he started, it was in the middle of the Seven-Year War, which is basically what we would call the First World War of sorts, because there was where there were multiple countries involved. And he came into the middle of that.
Right.
And in all intents and purposes, I think he handled it very well. But then when they had to do the peace treaty, they felt that France should have been harder hit. But his whole point was that, you know, if you do, they're going to come back harder. You know?
Well, it's interesting you bring up France, because throughout his reign, there were a lot of comparisons with France, and France didn't make the better decisions. You know, if you look back at that time, the French Revolution happened during George III's reign. And if England hadn't been managed better and it wasn't a constitutional democracy, it might have gone the same way as France had. And France was a bloodbath for a long time. After that, Napoleon came along.
Yeah.
And most of Napoleon's real victories and his conquests were achieved under George III's reign, even though by then he'd gone crazy. And it was England who had to defeat Napoleon. It was England who everyone looked to, because the rest of Europe was in disarray.
Yeah, so Wellington was part of under George III's era.
Yeah. Look, he went through a series of prime ministers. I mean, among them are famously William Pitt, George Fox. There were a lot of very interesting politicians.
And Butt.
And Lord Bute.
Is
Don't
it
call
not
him Butt, but I know what
sorry,
you mean.
Yeah.
But he was alleged to be having an affair with George's mother. So,
because they were very close to family.
Very close.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot that went on in this guy's reign because it was also such a long reign. And the interesting thing about him and his wife, Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, who also never really learned to speak English properly. I mean, she would ask for things in German. She didn't know how to speak English very well. And when she did speak English, it was with a very bad accent. And the children, some of them also end up speaking like this, yeah, because they were around their mother all the time. Like the daughters, the younger daughters were always around the mother, and they were very coddled. The sons were maniacs. They were like real playboy princes. They had women and fast chariots, and they spent money, and they had seaside homes, and, you know, they were really like the first European aristocrash. And George was horrified because he was a tremendously moral man. Mm. He never cheated on Charlotte once, which was extraordinary.
It was in that
considering
era.
I mean, all of his ancestors were
correct,
jumping from one woman's bed to another. Mm. All of his children were jumping, his sons anyway, were jumping from one bed to another, and there was George holding the fort.
Yeah, and he didn't even know his wife. So the first time he saw was at the time they were going to get married. He didn't know at all. I mean,
and he made a go of it.
And 50 years, I think, or something.
Look,
crazy.
Unfortunately, towards the end, he was so deranged that he didn't even know she died. But he loved her to the end, and he, I think, was devoted to her in a way that we don't see often in, you know, the marriages of very important, very rich, very powerful, and very royal people.
But often you don't think of in war. War's massively costly.
Yeah.
And the Seven-Year War is basically who was going to fall first, who was going to run out of money first. And France actually ran out of money, but England was struggling as well. I mean, didn't have much money. And I think that's really started, to a certain extent, the rot in their colonies, is that they wanted to up the taxes to get some money and to recoup money.
There's this conspiracy theory which was bandied about that the English were levying unfair taxes on the Americans. And it suited the Americans who wanted independence to say so. But George really had removed almost all their taxes by a certain point. And he kept the tea tax because he said otherwise they're going to think that we can't ever levy a tax again. So even though we've removed all of these, we'll keep that one. But they were looking for an excuse. Boston was the scene of it with the Boston
Tea Party.
And George really didn't have anything to do with the ultimate loss of America. His own choice for prime minister, I think it was Lord North at the time, had lost pretty much all public support for a war. There'd been the defeats at Yorktown and various others that it just wasn't any more something that he could keep holding on to. And George was quite removed from the decision-making with respect to America. He was a proper constitutional monarch.
But once they'd lost the colonies, he said, "Now I'm prepared to work with you."
Well, yeah, he met John Adams famously. And John Adams ended up being the second president of the United States later on. But he was emissary to Britain straight after independence. So you can imagine that first meeting with the king was very awkward. And George III is reputed to have said, "I was the last to consent to the separation. But the separation having been made and having become inevitable, I have always said, as I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power." So he was sensible.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, France went into the war, Louis XVI, before he had his head chopped off. he went in to assist the colony against England. But funny enough, not too long after that, because of the way George was, they became allies again, the American colony and England. So.
Right.
That turned against the French.
Now, slavery was a big issue during his lifetime, and he was pro-slavery. There are not a lot of people who will be counted among the pro-slavers now because it's not a very popular position to take. But at the time, he thought it was a good idea, but he didn't make abolition a cabinet measure. As a result, he kind of let his ministers decide in their individual capacity what they wanted to do. So he played this game of chess with Parliament the whole time, which is what a constitutional monarch should do if they're any good. He interfered some of the time, and he was often reprimanded for it by the public or by the politicians. And sometimes he forced his way, because he could constitutionally do that.
But the Parliament, wasn't it quite divided? There was a lot of...
So this is really the era where the Whigs and the Tories came to prominence, what eventually would become the left and the right of modern politics. And it's a fascinating story. I don't want to go too much into all the different prime ministers, because they could be episodes on their own. But what happened is that George IV, who was at that stage Prince of Wales, would ally with the Whigs just to upset his father. Mm. And his father would take it as a personal insult if the Whigs won an election and they supported the Prince of Wales. It was almost like you had two battling households going on here the whole time. And really, George IV was a bit of a disappointment to his father. You know, George III was working hard here to try and ensure that Britain was moving ahead scientifically, agriculturally, in terms of exploration, in terms of government, in terms of education, everything else. They were trying to make the country a real first world power for that time. And George IV was interested in drinking and partying and dressing up and decorating his houses.
And then, unfortunately, he had an episode, you know, where this malady, which affected him a lot in his life, it happened in Parliament. He needed to make a decision on what to do in case that George III would never come back.
Yeah.
And that's where they had to do something in terms of the law for the prince. And
they instituted the regency.
The regency, correct.
But this whole story of George going mad, and there's lots of new evidence. They found a lock of his hair a while ago, and they tested it, and they found some arsenic in it, which means that he may have, not that he was poisoned, but he may have been exposed to poisonous wallpapers or whatever else. I mean, they say that's what killed Napoleon. But they initially blamed the disease porphyria, which is a rare blood disease.
Which means you get purple. Your urine goes purple.
And porphyria, whatever it was that drove him mad, he certainly was, you know, slightly wacky. Mm. He used to say, what, at the end of every sentence. He would talk to animals all the time. He would talk to trees and address them as if they were other kings.
But that's not abnormal, is it?
Isn't it? He'd play games with his equerries where he'd ride on their backs like they were horses. This is when he was totally mad. I mean, he was a good guy. I mean, he just loved going up to ordinary people in a straw hat and saying, "How do you do? What? I am the king. Who are you?" And then they'd talk to him. I mean, maybe that's where, you know, the current royals get it from. "Hello, what do you do?" And, you know, that kind of thing. But this is what this is his social idea of being king, is that he would go around and talk to everybody. Mm. I mean, in private, he was probably a lot more serious. But he did go crazy. And, I mean, he had a tough time physically. You know, in those days, they didn't know how to deal with mental illness. So they would bleed you.
Mm.
They would put leeches on you.
And they did use arsenic in some form, to try and see if you could help.
And they'd beat him. And they'd put him in a straitjacket. Mm. I mean, can you imagine beating the king? Putting him in a straitjacket, and he'd be screaming because he didn't know what was going on. He was deranged. And he would do inappropriate things, like he'd pull down his pants and pee in the middle of a, you know, concert recital or whatever. So it became a bit of a problem. And he did dip in and out of this. I mean, in law, they call it a lucidum intervallum, where you come out and you're clear for a while, but then you go straight back into the madness. So it was a very sad thing to see. But he had been king for a very long time, and he'd been mostly a stable influence on things. And eventually, you know, they decided after his third major episode, that it wasn't likely that he was going to come back.
Yeah.
But all the while, he had set up the English monarchy as an example of what he wanted a king and a queen and a royal family to be. And that example was inherited by all of his heirs, and probably continues more or less to this day, which is why things like the abdication were such a scandal, why Charles and Diana's marriage breakdown was such a scandal, because the idea that George III put in play in the late 1700s remained a fruitful idea of what monarchy should be in the modern world, all the way up to the modern moment.
And even the ratification of the Prime Minister.
Yes.
I mean, that started with him.
Yeah, well, the whole relationship between the government and the monarchy was sort of put in place by maybe his predecessor, George II, but mostly him.
Mm.
And it remains that way. Sadly, for the last 7 or 8 years of his life, he was blind, he was deaf, he had long hair, a long beard.
But when he lost his sight, he would get people to read to him all the time. And so he was still trying very hard. I think that what pushed him over the edge was when his daughter died. And
his youngest daughter was Princess Amelia.
And they were close.
He loved his children. I mean, he was fond of all of them. He grew to dislike the Prince of Wales, but the rest of them he absolutely loved. And, of course, Queen Victoria's father, who was his fourth son, Edward, Duke of Kent, he died before George III, but he didn't even know what was going on by then. And when Amelia died a few years before that, it really hurt him. Yeah. He wrote letters to Charlotte. He was already kind of locked away and didn't see much of the family. I mean, he must have been quite a sad character. He was wandering around on the ground floor apartments, which they'd set aside for him, probably padded the walls. Nobody went to visit him anymore. He was just a deranged old man, and there's a very sad picture of him that was the last portrait painted of him. It's a miniature, actually. And it's just this very old man who's kind of staring into the distance because he can't see anymore, he can't hear anymore. So it's all kind of a sad story at the end, because he had been the most educated, most interesting man in Britain, who had his hands on all the gears for a long time, and then suddenly he was this invalid who was insane.
Yeah, that is actually very sad.
But an incredible life.
Yes, I mean, if you look at what he had to deal with, I mean, the French Revolution must have been scary to any monarch across the world.
Can you imagine?
So, and the fact, the point that you raised earlier was that England didn't go down that road. Is testimony to, first of all, the respect that they had for him. And even the Americans, it was 50% of them wanted to stay under the monarchy.
Well, they had a big statue up in New York to him.
Yeah,
which
I mean,
they only pulled down in about the 1800s or so.
Yeah, so I mean, the fact is that he had good support. And, and like I said, he had very strong work ethic.
Yeah, good guy.
Yeah.
I think he was for his time, he was a very advanced monarch and thought forward rather than backward.
Yeah, and I think that his progeny that went forward, I mean, Queen Victoria was special beside odd impressive moments. But
well, she totally took over his mantle. Mm. And I think she implemented a lot of the things that he would have probably done if he'd lived at her time.
100%.
So overall, a good guy. I mean, he was proper crazy a lot of the time, which is also, I think, quite charming, because there's an English eccentricity that borders on madness, which we still associate with the royal family. And it's all because of him. In the middle of a Handel concert, when they were playing the Hallelujah chorus one time, he got up and started dancing with Queen Charlotte. He just decided this was too good to sit down. I mean, you didn't do that. If you were a king, you sat there and everybody clapped when you clapped. He loved it. Anyway, George III, God save the king. What?
What?
Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cliffcentral.com